Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, July the 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump wants more things made in America.
Since the beginning of the year, we have already created over 50,000 brand new manufacturing jobs.
Just what is behind Russia's desire to meddle in U.S. affairs?
Reports that the Russian intelligence services pay grandmothers who sit outside of train stations in Russia to spy on people.
Why air travel could get a whole lot worse in the coming decades. Also ahead, Planet of the Apes is soaring in U.S. theaters. We'll have a review. It's all on today's International Edition. President Trump inspected products brought to the White House on Monday from all 50 U.S. states to launch his Made in America Week. The weekly themed campaign of the six-month-old Trump administration, and there are more to come in the next few weeks, is meant to highlight the importance of U.S. manufacturing and tout its policies to bring jobs back to the U.S.
We're here today to celebrate American manufacturing and to showcase the amazing products from all 50 states made in the USA. Remember in the old days, they used to have made in the USA, made in America, but made in the USA. We're going to start doing that again. We're going to put that brand on our product because it means it's the best.
On display from the easternmost state of Maine was a yacht. From the distant shores of Hawaii, there was a bottle of rum. And even Marine One, the presidential helicopter, was turned into an expensive prop to tout Connecticut manufacturing. The president also hopped into a Wisconsin fire truck and then signed a proclamation declaring July 17th as Made in America Day.
And over the next short period of time, you're going to see things announced that you won't even believe for our country and for selling product in our country and making product in our country and things that are great for American jobs. You're going to be seeing that happening really quickly.
Monday's launch, however, was somewhat overshadowed by the fact that many, if not most, of the Trump family business products are made in foreign factories. Also, trade analysts say it's not that simple because we're now an interconnected global economy. Well, as the White House looks to change the subject on the Russia investigation, President Trump is continuing to defend his eldest son's meeting last year with a Russian lawyer he expected was going to hand him incriminating material about Trump's election challenger, Democrat Hillary Clinton. He tweeted Monday, quote, "Most politicians would have gone to a meeting like the one Don Jr. attended in order to get info on an opponent. That's politics." Trump has tried several times now to defuse the controversy. President Trump has also said he only learned of the meeting in the last week. But Democratic Senator Mark Warner, the leading Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, said he finds it unbelievable that Trump was not told about the meeting. Well, joining me now to discuss why the Russians might want to have this sort of meeting is Lauren Goodrich, senior Eurasia analyst and Soviet Union specialist with Stratfor. Lauren, thank you for being with us. So the lawyer that met with Donald Trump Jr. apparently has ties to the Russian government. Is this the kind of thing that the Russian government would do to send someone else that isn't in the government but possibly an ally to try to make connections with people they want something from?
Very much so. I mean, Russia, especially this current regime that is running Russia, has all these layers going down that of interconnectedness within personalities. And to have those key figures that would fly underneath the radar of, say, you know, the NSA or the CIA, in which those people could actually reach out and have meetings on behalf of the Kremlin, but not necessarily be, you know, official enough to catch the eye of, you know, Western security services. And Russia is very good at creating these deep, deep, deep layers that go down to the most innocuous people who would be working for, say, the Russian intelligence services. I think one of my favorite examples is that there's reports that the Russian intelligence services pay the grandmothers who sit outside of, you know, train stations in Russia to spy on people. I mean, it goes down to the very nitty-gritty inside of Russia when it comes to their security services and their ability to spy on people without them knowing.
Do you think that they were deliberately sort of cultivating relationships within the Trump campaign?
I would say that instead the Kremlin was feeling out all of its options. And the Kremlin doesn't play a straightforward game. They create a chessboard in which the Russian government can move a piece that they weren't expecting to move when they need to because they're first plan or their third plan or their 20th plan didn't work out. And so I think that the Kremlin at the time was just trying to create as many options as possible, as many avenues of discussion as possible, in order to be able to move pieces as they needed, because they know that the United States, especially the U.S. and any U.S. administration, is filled with constraints. And so that's why the Kremlin has to create these multi-layered options.
What is your observation from President Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin?
I thought the optics were very smart on both sides. Both went in with a very low bar. And the low bar was to, are we going to just simply reopen up dialogues between the two countries? Because there hasn't been an official summit between the United States and Russia in over 2 years. And because of that, there's been signals pretty much to Russia's borderlands, which are its most important concern at this time, that U.S.-Russian relations were just pretty much at a standstill. And creating the optics of the two leaders being able to come together and have a very warm dialogue is a start to reshape what those optics are for all those borderland states and for the rest of the world as well. It's a low bar, but it at least is something that they were able to achieve. The problem now is that there's very little room for them to move or progress in any other area. Every single arena, whether it's Ukraine or North Korea or Syria or sanctions, each has multiple layers of you know, restrictions on how far the two can actually progress for their own strategies. I think they're hitting walls right now, and it's going to get worse now that we have even more leaks coming out concerning U.S.-Russia backroom ties, which is going to, you know, create even more stir within Congress and within the Senate.
Lauren Goodrich, senior Eurasia analyst and Soviet Union specialist with Stratford. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the other stories we are following at voanews.com. The Trump administration will share records about Mar-a-Lago. Denmark will train NATO soldiers to combat Russian misinformation. Chinese overfishing threatens West African economies. And two Iranians are charged in the U.S. for hacking and selling weapons software. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. South Korea is proposing military talks and family reunions with North Korea to reduce the increasing potential for conflict over Pyongyang's continued development of nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Troy Stangerone, senior director at the Korea Economic Institute, what he makes of the efforts.
The family reunions, I don't think, should be objectionable to anyone. Many of these individuals are in the last years of their lives. They haven't seen their relatives. And if we don't find a way for this to happen soon, they're not likely to. So I don't think that there's any real objection there. So my guess would be is that this is the question of military to military talks. Now, while I think everyone agrees that we should continue the process of pressure, at the recent U.S.-Korea summit, President Trump did endorse South Korea trying to take and see if there was a possibility for dialogue, which is something that I think we all realize that if we're going to solve this problem, we're going to have to develop. I think it's unlikely that the North Koreans will respond in a positive fashion, but I think it's understandable why South Korea did this. You know, it'll be interesting to see why Japan specifically seems to be making these comments, but I think South Korea's moves are something that Moon Jae-in has both said and something that President Trump himself seemed to endorse at the summit.
It seems interesting that it comes just a week after the, or 2 weeks, the test by North Korea of its first operable ICBM.
I think the challenge here is, you know, we haven't seen a new sanction resolution come out yet. We have a situation to where the United States, it looks like, is going to take and potentially go after some additional Chinese entities, banks, and perhaps a few other individuals. So we're seeing the U.S. follow the pressure path. But in terms of timing, I've done some research, and essentially North Korea averages a test every 2 weeks at this point. Clearly, the average doesn't reflect the actual spread of the test. But I think, you know, given the way the North Korea's program is going right now, if you're going to try to take and get them to dialogue, you're likely going to be doing that in the shadow of a test. I think that's just the reality at this point, given how frequently they test.
U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley told the Security Council earlier this month that if it remains united, the international community can cut off major sources of hard currency to North Korea, restrict oil to its military and weapons programs, increase air and maritime restrictions and hold senior officials accountable. Would this be any different from past resolutions, and is China, with its veto power, a key in this dialogue?
I think Ambassador Haley is exactly right. If we could do all those things, we could take and put pressure on the North Koreans. The challenge has been that regardless of the resolutions passed, they either have not been enforced fully. In some cases, some countries don't have the capacity to enforce them. But, you know, this is the challenge. Everybody has not been on the same page in terms of what should be done. If you look back at, you know, the last two prior resolutions, the Russian government has sought exceptions for some of their activities with North Korea. So, you know, we have these debates over some countries like Russia trying to carve out certain areas such as the Rason coal exports from Russia. You have a situation to where obviously Beijing is concerned about applying too much pressure and potentially causing the regime itself to collapse. So I think the difficulty is that she's right. If we could get everyone on the same page, we could really convince the North Koreans that, you know, this is something everyone is serious about and that they need to reconsider their actions. The challenge has been is that there's consistently been, you know, differences of perspective and enforcement from different countries.
That's Troy Stangerone, Senior Director at the Korea Economic Institute. Well, U.S. researchers say air travel could become even more of a headache thanks to a warming planet. According to a new study by over 2,000 U.S. researchers at Columbia University, climate change may ground a third of aircraft in the coming decades. Joining me now to discuss is Jeffrey Gracer, environmental attorney with the New York firm Syve Paget and Reisel. So how would climate change impact air travel?
Well, as the atmosphere warms, the dynamics in the air change, including the ability of airplanes to take off because the density of the air changes. So you need longer runways and you have to have lighter airplanes. So it's not at all surprising. I mean, you can't wall yourself off from the climate. So you're flying through the air. The air is impacted by temperature. So if there's more temperature and if there's more extreme weather, it's going to disrupt air travel. And that's what they're seeing. That's what the study shows, is that even relatively minor changes in the overall atmospheric temperature will have eventually pretty significant impacts on air travel.
What kinds of things are they talking about as far as an impact goes? What will we be seeing?
We'll be seeing at least smaller planes, regional jetliners not being able to take off on shorter runways, which is what happened at the Phoenix airport a couple of weeks ago, where it was over 120 degrees, and American Airlines, I believe, had to cancel numerous flights out into and out of Phoenix. It just changes the way the airplanes behave and makes it unsafe to fly.
I guess there would be a spiral effect from all of this?
I think this is just one example of all of the multiple ways that global warming will impact commerce. It's not just going to impact airlines. It's going to impact shipping, both on the seas as well as in rivers. It's going to impact the companies that specialize in logistics like FedEx to move product around. There have already been numerous examples of companies with major warehouses that have been destroyed by tornadoes, flooding, and other extreme weather events. So the airline is certainly the most newsworthy, but there are many other iterations of this.
So as far as air travel goes, what do you see for the future with the planet continuing to warm? Do you think that it will cause less air travel, more delays, but continued at the same level as far as people wanting to travel? And do you think the aviation industry needs to do something to prepare for this? Do you think that overall we're going to have less people flying?
I think the aviation industry will have to do whatever it can to adapt, and that may mean having larger airplanes, having airplanes that are engineered to fly in at higher temperature. But at the end of the day, I believe what the airlines should be doing and everyone else should be doing is trying to mitigate these changes as much as possible in a commercially reasonable way, obviously. But the airline industry, like the shipping industry, is subject to its own rules and regulations. There's a lot of self-governance involved in that, in those two industries, and they're lagging behind some of the other measures that major corporations are taking to address climate change. So I think that they're going to have to get on board and mitigate the impacts that are affecting their own industries pretty significantly.
And looking at this study, it looks like they've even been able to narrow this down down to the airports around the world that will be most affected.
That's right. They looked at the characteristics of different airports to see how these temperature changes would impact them. So, for example, in New York City, LaGuardia Airport, which has a relatively short runway, would be much more adversely affected than JFK. I believe they looked at Heathrow and found that the runways there were sufficiently long that it would have a lesser impact. But this is what's happening. People are now, the reality of climate change is beginning to dawn on people, and people are going back and looking at the data and the projections and the science and applying them at zip code level to the facilities and infrastructure that impact daily life and are beginning to understand what this is going to mean.
All right, Jeffrey Graser, environmental attorney with the New York firm of Seif, Paget & Reisel. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, in recent months, Silicon Valley has been shaken over bias and harassment allegations raised by women in the industry. High-profile executives have left their firms, including Uber's CEO. The controversy casts a shadow over a unique part of the U.S. tech industry, the startup ecosystem. VOA's Deanna Mitchell reports from San Mateo, California.
This is no normal workout. More than 30 female venture capitalists, lawyers, and business leaders took part in an indoor cycling event to try to raise awareness about a problem that many feel has long been overlooked in Silicon Valley: how male venture capitalists perceive and treat female startup founders and employees. The Spinning as Protest is the brainchild of Tim Draper, a prominent venture capitalist.
This is an exciting time for women. And I'm all for it, and let's go. Let's start businesses. There's no glass ceiling if you start your own business.
I think men have to be very important champions for women empowerment, because the reality is that most decision makers today on the top, political business leaders, are men. So they have to be part of the change.
Many women in Silicon Valley are telling their stories about gender-based discrimination faced when pitching ideas to venture capitalists, who are almost always men, and harassment they've received in a male-dominated industry.
You pitch your idea, and they go, oh, that's really interesting, and it was more like they were just setting up dates.
Dent, a former model-turned-tech entrepreneur, says she faced harassment during conversations with a would-be advisor.
What was I going to do, go to the police?
Dent, instead, focused on Cinemerse, the app she was creating for smartwatches.
I fell deeply into a hole and didn't know what to do, and I learned to code. I decided, he's not going to win.
The willingness of more women to publicly come forward, talking publicly and posting their experiences on social media, is making an impact on the venture capital industry. In the case of Uber, the company's financial backers ultimately pressed for the ousting of the CEO.
We can use things like social media now and other many outlets we have, not just the courts, to communicate what we're all seeing within the industry. And I think that's one of the biggest changes.
By taking to social media, women are using technology to change the social construct of the tech world. Deanna Mitchell in San Mateo, California, for VOA News.
Well, turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, we have a free speech case on social media, one of the issues that we often talk about here, free speech and social media, and this is involving Facebook, another thing we often talk about here on the show.
Can't get enough of that.
Can't get enough of Facebook. Well, Facebook is among a number of tech companies and civil liberty groups that are filing a lawsuit against a court order that says tech companies cannot let their users know when investigators are searching their social media. This, according to the Washington Post, pertains to a case that occurred around the time of the inauguration, when a number of protesters were smashing windows and overturning garbage cans throughout Washington, D.C. as the presidential inauguration was going on this year. And a number of those people were arrested and charged with felony rioting. Now, as part of the investigation into that, the government looked into some of these people's social media accounts but didn't notify them or didn't allow the social media companies to notify them. So Facebook is arguing it should be allowed to let those people know that the social media profiles are being looked at and used to build the government's case against them. They're saying it's a free speech issue, that you should be able to know who's accessing your information and what they're doing with it. One of the many new frontiers we're being faced as far as what information is public, what's private, what can be controlled by the government, and what can be controlled by social media companies. We've talked about this a lot with extremism, but this is a case where it's pertaining to a legal matter.
Wow. All right. What else is going on? Anything?
Yes. Well, one place where information is very much controlled by and dictated by the government is China. And an interesting situation going on in China online, the government there has blocked any mention of Winnie the Pooh.
What?
Of course, the beloved yellow bear from the children's stories by A.A. Milne. Yeah, that's what I said when I saw this. I said, what? What exactly is going on here? Apparently, it pertains to an online meme comparing Chinese President Xi Jinping and others to the yellow bear and his friends. So there was one meme from several years ago that put an image of Winnie the Pooh and his friend Tigger side by side with a photo of President Barack Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping when they were meeting. Another one had President Xi and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe shaking hands, and next to that was a picture of Winnie the Pooh and his friend Eeyore, the depressed donkey, shaking hands. So China has banned these images. Some folks in China have found their ways to get around it and put them up online, but it's another instance of China stepping up censorship online. And it's interesting when you look at the timing of this, because China's 19th Communist Party Congress is coming up. And so usually when they have these Communist Party Congresses, they try to crack down on different speech and increase censorship. So this appears to be the case here. They're worried perhaps that President Xi Jinping is going to get the Winnie the Pooh treatment again during their Communist Congress, and they don't want that to happen. But certainly something that's capturing a lot of global attention and turning a lot of heads around the world.
I bet. All right, Andrew, thank you.
Thank you.
And you can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, the latest installment of the movie series Planet of the Apes is proving to be a winner in U.S. theaters. Joining me now for details on the smash hit, Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, usually when there are sequels, the movies get kind of stale. Sounds like that's not the case here.
We had the ones from the 60s, and then we had one from the 90s from Tim Burton. This is the newer ones, and the technology in making these apes is just mind-blowing. I mean, the original, it was an Oscar-winning makeup, but now they've completely used something called motion capture, which is where when you're watching these apes, when you're watching them move and do the dialogue and all of that, those are real people. Those aren't totally made up in the computer. So every nuance of their dialogue, of their facial expressions, they use special effects to enhance that. And a lot of people are saying, well, that's not really that acting. It's a computer doing that. Well, absolutely. This movie is going to change your mind because, you know, Andy Serkis stars as Caesar, who's the leader of the Ape Rebellion, and he was famous for doing motion capture back for Lord of the Rings, you know, doing Gollum and all of that. Well, he's taken it to just the next level with this movie. And this is the third one in the series. You had Rise of the Planet of the Apes in 2011, then you had Dawn of the Planet of the Apes in 2014, and now we have War of the Planet of the Apes. And it all stems back from when they were trying to find a cure for Alzheimer's, and it started a disease that it backfired and started killing human beings, but it gave intelligence to the apes. So each movie, as it progresses, you know, Caesar was getting more and more intelligent. This time, in the past two films, he's been very compassionate and merciful. He embodied the best of humanity. Well, this time around, and I won't give the spoiler away, something sets him off in the beginning of the film on a path of revenge and redemption. And he meets up with the human army led by a hell-bent colonel played by Woody Harrelson. And his attitude is, we must exterminate the apes and let mankind continue because this is a war for mankind. Now, I can't believe I'm saying this, but this is one of the most remarkable movies. It's the best one in the series. It's almost like on a Shakespearean level. And when I say that, is that you invest emotionally so much into these characters, you can't believe, and that's the only way this movie is going to work. The dialogue, the action sequences, the allegory of humanity that's in the movie, it's just truly a remarkable film. It's one of my favorite films of the year, if not one of the best films of the summer. It's just totally incredible.
Wow, that's quite the endorsement. Usually after these have another sequel and another sequel, they sort of lose some of their effectiveness, but it sounds like that's not the case here.
It isn't. Yeah, as you go along with these movies and you get them, the story continues. This is definitely a trilogy. They kind of suffer from that, but this one just keeps getting better and better. And not only that, when you see these special effects and you realize the actors behind them, and you're just going to be totally mesmerized. It's almost like a new way of storytelling. And it's set up in the mountains of Colorado, so you've got snow adventure, you've got these amazing battle sequences, and there's humor in there too, because the movie's kind of heavy at times. And I just think Woody Harrelson's one of the greatest actors of our generation. And also, here's something, you try not to spoil the film, but it also connects the original 1960s film. So if you remember the Planet of the Apes, when humans couldn't talk and Charlton Heston was trying to figure out, what happened to human beings and the human race, they make reference to that now because we're at the very beginning of when all this happened. And so it kind of gives some foreshadowing to what happens in the original Planet of the Apes, which I thought was pretty cool.
That was Jeffrey K. Howard. Watch his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but you can find us anytime at VOAnews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zainab Abdul-Rahman. I'm Laurie London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The spread of violent extremism and terrorism pose significant challenges to Africa's security, long-term development goals, and democratic gains, said U.S. Ambassador to the African Union, Mary Beth Leonard. These threats to the global community, she warned, can only be addressed with a global response. Ambassador Leonard's remarks were made at a workshop earlier this month, co-hosted by the U.S. Mission to the African Union and the AU Commission on Preventing and Countering Violent Extremism. The workshop highlighted the use of public diplomacy resources such as exchanges and tech camps as successful examples of coordination to build security expertise within the AU, furthering the mission objective and advancing peace and security. The workshop supported the AU's 2002 Plan of Action for the Prevention and Combating of Terrorism, identified areas of potential collaboration, and charted a way for future engagement. On this continent, as elsewhere, a comprehensive approach where Africans are empowered to lead and devise their own solutions to address the drivers of violent extremism is critical to not only advancing the United States foreign policy goals, but to realizing the aims of Agenda 2063, an African continent that is peaceful and prosperous. The United States stands as your steadfast partner in achieving these goals, said Ambassador Leonard. With almost 70% of Africans under 25 years of age, Ambassador Leonard noted, it is important that all stakeholders see youth as partners for peace rather than as the cause of conflict. Additionally, when women are included in peace and security efforts, in peacekeeping missions, peace negotiations, and political decision-making, communities are safer. I know from experience that the security challenges in Africa are formidable. But by marshaling our values, our partnerships, and our resources, I'm confident that together we can overcome them, she said. And I would like to end by reiterating that the United States remains a steadfast partner for Africa and continues to stand by the AU in its bold vision for sustainable peace and prosperity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.